This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 26th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 344. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and the big deal feature, the gap is narrowing between the NDP and the Conservatives. BC United and the BC Greens are struggling to stay relevant. The major issues have not changed. With 21 weeks until BC Election Day, I catch up with Mario Canseco, the president of Research Co., to talk about his latest opinion poll. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. 21 weeks to go until Election Day in British Columbia. Premier David Eby and his NDP are looking for another 4 years in office, while John Rastad's Conservatives think that they are the free enterprise option. A new poll from Research Co. shows that Kevin Falgan's BC United could be battling with Sonia Firstnow's Green Party for third-party status. It says 42% of respondents would vote for the NDP, and 32% of decided voters support the Conservatives. BC United, the opposition party, and the Greens are tied at 10% each. I welcome back regular guest Mario Canseco, president of Research Co. The only issues that are in double digits, by a long shot, remain housing, poverty, homelessness at 40%. The respondents said that was their top issue. Respondents said 21% of the time that healthcare was the top issue, and number three was economy and jobs at 15%. This has been pretty solid for quite a long time. Not much movement in terms of position, not much movement in terms of proportion. Why do you think that is, and how do you think that will play out 21 weeks from now when voters go to the polls?
Well, it's an extraordinary climb for housing as an issue. Going back to the 2009 election, for instance, it would barely register. People were more likely to be worried about the economy and jobs. We were coming off the global financial crisis, so that made sense. But the numbers had never been as high as they are right now. Even in 2020, we started to see housing climbing as an issue to a lesser extent in 2017, but never at 40%. It's usually something that is only reserved to healthcare if things are going terribly, or sometimes it's the economy and jobs. The other issue that is remarkable and certainly hurts the Greens is how low the environment has fallen as an issue. Usually it's in double digits. Sometimes it gets to maybe 15 or 16%. Now at 5%, it isn't really something that they can use to try to connect with the younger demographic that usually looks at the Greens as an option they can support, because that young demographic is very worried about housing. And the other issue that certainly throws a wrench into BC United is how low crime and safety is. It's at 5%. We started off with BC United talking about going really hard on the issue of crime. And we see only 1 in 20 British Columbians who believe that this is the number one issue facing BC. So it's not going to be a winning strategy to try to hammer all of your ideas related to public safety when it's something that most British Columbians aren't worried about right now.
Is there any room for Kevin Falcon to gain back support, or for the Conservatives to lose support among decided voters?
Well, there's a couple of issues at play that could benefit either of the parties. One of the complexities of the BC Conservatives is we don't see the same level of emotional connection that we see on the voting question in the approval question. They're at 32%, they're up 5 points since April, climbing the charts. This is essentially a statistical tie with the NDP in southern British Columbia, northern British Columbia, and the Fraser Valley. So this is something that we didn't see happening probably a year ago. So it's been a steady climb on the vote, but we really haven't seen that emotional connection with John Rostath. You know, to me, this really echoes the campaign of 2009, when there was a moment when the NDP under Carol James was leading in voting, but we never saw Carol James climbing, getting ahead as the best premier, or being seen as somebody whose numbers on her own personal level were going to be higher than what we saw for Gordon Campbell. And at the end, you know, we had an election where the Liberals ended up with another majority. I think that is the main challenge for John Ross, that can you be that vehicle for change and establish that emotional connection with voters? They're doing well with the 18 to 34 demographic. And we know that young people usually don't vote as much as those over the age of 55. And the other message of the survey in that sense is the NDP effectively supplanting the BC Liberals as the de facto establishment party for the over 55s. You know, they're at 50% with this group, people who maybe are not as disappointed with the way things are going and are not seeing a vehicle out there that is going to be better than the one that the NDP has. The main difficulty for United is the rebrand is certainly not working well. You know, we've seen a drop in support from the first time we asked about BC United in May of 2023, when they were at 33%. Down to 12%. So it's a significant drop. It's 21 points lower than where they were when they announced this rebrand. And the problem is, we ran a question related to, would you vote for BC United if all of these different candidates were in place of Kevin Falcon? And the numbers aren't really that superior. You know, we have the party at 18% with Christy Clark as leader, the party at 18% with Diane Watts as leader, 14% with Michael Lee, 13% with Gavin Dew. These aren't numbers that are going to move things. So part of the complexity is there was no really rebirth of the ideas of the party, no way to connect. It was essentially just changing a logo, adding different colors, and you know, voters are now looking at the Conservatives as an option that they would support if they're dissatisfied with things. So I think it has more to do with the inability of the BC Liberals to try to, well, BC United now, to try to run a campaign like the one the BC Liberals used to run. Endless corporate money, AstroTurf groups, having the opportunity to have other people doing your messaging. And ultimately, the one thing that made Christy Clark's tenure different, which was that she was in government. You can steer policy through. Kevin Falcon has none of those things right now.
Unless, of course, a miracle happens during barbecue season during the summer and somehow the BC United and Conservatives kiss and make up.
Well, I think a lot of people would like to see something like that happen. There's an element of the base of support that would be happy with a merger, but it's not massive. You know, it's fewer than 50% of people who right now say they would vote for BC United or the BC Conservatives saying, I would welcome these two parties working together. But it's not massive. It's not 70%. It's not something that the entire base wants to see. And what I find really compelling about the numbers is when the race was closer between the two parties, when you had essentially BC United and the BC Conservatives tied or separated by 5 or 6 points, that's when a lot of people were saying, well, maybe we should work together because the splits are going to enable the NDP to win seats with 35, 37% of the vote. Now that you have a clear winner and you have a clear distance between the BC Conservatives and BC United, people are having second thoughts. You know, maybe this isn't the right course of action. There's a vehicle here that has the momentum, that can do very well, that could actually do, you know, maybe actually have a shot at forming the government if the situation continues to go as it has been going over the past few months. So I think part of the complexity here is the BC Conservative voters saying, we have a shot at this. Why would we extend our hand and try to bring BC United in? And there's also the added complexity of all the candidates that have been nominated. I mean, what are you going to do if there's a merger? Do you go to the BC United incumbents and say, well, you guys are running and we're asking the BC Conservatives not to run? Or do you flip a coin? Like, it's just going to be too complicated to try to figure something like that. But I think the end game, in a way, is, you know, it's a close election, maybe something similar to 2017. BC United having 3 or 4 seats that hold the balance of power if they continue to do well, and then try to strike a deal similar to the one that we had between John Horgan and Andrew Weaver. But a merger, the time for this was probably December of last year. And now the Conservatives are thinking to themselves, we're 10 points behind the NDP. Why would we even consider this?
Now, you also, through this survey, looked at the differences between John Rastad and Ken Falcon. You asked the respondents a number of questions of how they rate Kevin Falcon versus John Rastad. What surprised you?
The thing that is really striking is that it started off as Falcon having the edge on most of these items on John Rostad. When we started asking this question, Rostad was seen as, you know, maybe he'll do well in the Fraser Valley, but he won't do well in the island. He's not going to do well with women. And, you know, Kevin Falcon is going to do better with all of these groups. And now we only have Falcon defeating Rostad on attracting female voters and voters in Metro Vancouver. Everything else is a tie or something where John Rostad is significantly ahead. And I think this really speaks about the complexities of the Kevin Falcon situation, because he was better known, of course. He was a former minister, handled important portfolios. And at the time when we started asking this head-to-head comparison, he was doing better than Rostad. And now what we see is the pull of the conservative brand making people think, you know, maybe Rostad is going to be better. He has a better shot at forming the government, even, or at forming the official opposition after we have this election. You know, these are items where just a few months ago, Kevin Falcon was ahead. And it certainly shows the difficulty that they've had trying to connect with a new brand and a new situation in place. You don't drop 21 points because you did something right.
Kevin Falcon and BC United have been doing things right on a few occasions, a few notable occasions. 2022, if you remember, John Horgan was going to spend $1 billion to build a new Royal BC Museum, and Kevin Falcon and BC United really led the charge to force the NDP to change course on that. And of course, this year, the whole controversy over street drug use and weapons in hospitals, he has led BC United to some key policy wins to embarrass the NDP to change course.
There's echoes of the 2015 federal campaign in a way. You know, it starts with Mulcair really hammering the conservatives about everything. They have that ad with Dean Del Mastro in chains. You know, you have a lot of people who are starting to generate this feeling of animosity towards an incumbent government, but you're not sealing the deal. You know, Justin Trudeau comes in, and that is the moment when that opposition vote galvanizes around an option that is going to make it easier to topple the government. And I see echoes of that in the situation that we have right now. You know, Falcon very critical of the NDP and the things that they're doing, but because of the conservative brand, people looking at John Rostad as that vehicle for change, even though they hasn't that we haven't really seen that level of emotional connection that is necessary for things to be different.
The NDP lead at the start of the year when you did your previous survey looked insurmountable. They looked like they were going to cruise into October, that maybe EB would even call an election sooner. But the NDP has had a shaky 2024. I mean, look what happened with Selena Robinson's departure from cabinet and then a month later from caucus over her defense of Israel in the Israel-Hamas war and her fight against anti-Semitism. That situation there that showed a deep divide within the NDP. I saw it firsthand back in March. Mike Farnworth, Deputy Premier and Solicitor General, came to Lynn Valley for a roundtable at the Lynn Valley Legion. With several social housing agency managers. They told Farnworth, no uncertain terms, that they were having a problem to keep up with rising poverty in the North Shore. They weren't able to fulfill the needs of very needy single mothers. Crisis situation they were describing to Mike Farnworth. Farnworth was in Lynn Valley and what was billed by government communications as a promotion of the budget. He was there to tell the good story of the NDP's election year budget. He was doing more listening than talking about these terrible, sad stories of people in dire straits in the North Shore. And at one point, he even admitted he didn't know that media had been invited to observe this forum. That showed that the NDP is not on its game. Maybe they can be defeated if there is an opposition vehicle that can get its act together sooner than later.
There's a complexity that is pretty evident at this stage, which is how do you address specific elements within the party that have been there forever, particularly activists, to a lesser extent, environmentalists, without any alienating the base that can deliver you your majority, which is the over 55 voter who maybe doesn't care too much about what is happening in Israel, who maybe isn't paying attention to climate change as much as the younger generation. That is the complexity that they're facing. And you know, it reminds me of the moment when Stephen Harper was about to become prime minister, and there were all of these discussions about how social conservatism was back, and we were going to be heading into a discussion about abortion. And he ended that in a heartbeat. You know, we're here to do fiscal conservatism. We're going to deal with things differently. I understand that this is important to the base, but I am not going to jeopardize everything that we worked for because of this tiny issue that you guys want to deal with at this stage. And I think it's going to be a similar situation for David Eby. You know, can you sustain the type of momentum that you have and the level of support that the party got because of John Horgan's leadership during the pandemic? You know, they got to 48% of the vote. You know, this isn't something that happens to the NDP most years. And, you know, there's a drop in that. You know, part of it is the change in leadership. But all you need to do is be a few points ahead of the Conservatives to try to win because of your level of support in Metro Vancouver. So that is the other issue that is interesting at this stage. You know, if we're going to see some of those BC Liberal ridings in Metro Vancouver suddenly looking at the Conservatives as an option, then the math isn't going to make a lot of sense because you no longer have the splits between the center-right to help you gain some of those seats.
This election race here in BC, only 21 weeks away, is also shaped by federal leaders who aren't aligned with the parties. I mean, the BC NDP has been for many years Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's favorite provincial party. And here you have on the other end of the scale, John Rustad and the BC Conservatives, or the Conservative Party of BC, like they want to be called, who are not actually part of the federal Conservative Party yet. He is riding on the coattails of federal leader Pierre Poilievre, who is seen as the prime minister in waiting based on all the opinion polls about the decline of the federal Liberals and the rise of the Conservatives. People want change. Do you think that the federal leaders are going to do something to try to distance themselves from what's going on in the BC election? Or do you think that they might use this as a bit of a test market themselves for the federal election, which is scheduled for October 2025?
What is really fascinating to watch at the federal level is the level of support that the Conservatives are getting in BC. They're getting closer to 50% of the vote. They haven't had those numbers since the Canadian Alliance under Stockwell Day in 2000. Stephen Harper was forming the government and not getting close to 50% of the vote in BC. So to see the level of connection that the electorate right now has with Poilievre is fascinating. Back in 2020, 2021, you had the emergence of the Horgan Trudeau voter, you know, somebody who was, you know, careful and wanted to talk about the pandemic management. We didn't see a lot of people who were NDP voters federally and NDP voters provincially. We saw a lot of people who were Liberal voters federally and NDP voters provincially. And what is interesting now is we don't see the emergence of that ideological voter. If this were something that is based purely on ideology, the BC Conservatives would be in first place, but they're not. And if it's something that is based only on the leadership of your provincial party, Jagmeet Singh would be doing a lot better than he is right now. And sometimes he's in second place, sometimes he's in third place, depending on the situation. So connecting on ideology is certainly going to be helpful. You know, if there's a benefit, let's say the Conservatives climb the charts, if there's a benefit for Pierre Poilievre to say, I am aligning my horse to John Rostad because he's going to be the next premier, that's definitely something that can happen. But it's going to be more important for the NDP to try to steer clear from that and to try to build the campaign around specific ideas that they want to champion and to criticize the Conservatives. You know, it's something that they've done since December. I think it's been evident that the main rival, particularly when it comes to ideology and certain issues that the NDP likes to talk about, is the Conservatives. You know, they haven't been paying a lot of attention to BC United. And in a way, that was something that helped them. You know, Falcon being very critical in the House of Commons. But if you're, sorry, in the Legislative Assembly, but if you're in a situation where your rival is actually not going to be as persistent in the legislature, then your job is a lot easier.
Thanks again for joining us on the podcast. Mario Canseco, president of Research Co.
My pleasure.
Now it's time
on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Taiwan news, outlying Taiwan island of Kinmen calm in face of Chinese drills. Residents and military personnel stationed on the island of Kinmen off the coast of China's Fujian province were stoical after 2 days of Chinese military drill. The Army's Kinmen Defense Command said it had not raised the alert level, while local fishers said they would still go out to sea as they needed to make a living. China began military drills after the inauguration of new President Lai Ching-te. Xi Jinping has threatened to invade the self-governing Democratic Island. In Nikkei Asia, Tesla pushes suppliers to produce parts outside of China and Taiwan. Move comes amid rising geopolitical tensions and competition from Chinese rivals. Suppliers making components such as printed circuit boards, displays, and electronics control unit systems for use in Tesla models sold outside of China have received the request from the American EV maker, according to six supply chain executives with direct knowledge of the matter. China and Taiwan produce the bulk of the world's vital electronics parts and components. In LNC.NC, Macron promises not to pass in force on constitutional reform provided the barriers are lifted. In a quick trip to New Caledonia via Vancouver, France's head of state promised emergency aid after the colossal damage caused by the rioters. Emmanuel Macron said he gave an additional few weeks to the parties, independentists and loyalists, to negotiate, and he pledged to make a progress point within a month. Riots began May 13th in the French colony, which is located between Australia and Fiji, as Kanak natives protested a new law to give French citizens of 10 years the right to vote. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, why First Lady Amy Kotek Wilson involvement with a big pharmaceutical company is noteworthy. Half a dozen pharma lobbyists say that they were amazed and envious at the access Johnson & Johnson got. According to state figures, the Oregon Health Plan paid nearly $1.4 billion for prescription drugs last year. It's a competitive marketplace, and although Oregon strives to be objective about buying the most effective and competitively priced drugs, lobbyists say the process remains intensely political. In other words, having friends in the governor's office could be influential. In Crosscut, WSF says building new diesel ferries would create a 2-year delay. The two Democrats and two Republicans, considered the frontrunners to replace Jay Inslee as Washington's governor, have all indicated they would be receptive to replacing the first two hybrid ferries with diesel-only boats if that speeds the replacement process. In 2023, the legislature directed the Washington State Ferries to build 5 hybrid ferries. Other legislation allocated $1.3 billion to build them. New legislation would be needed in 2025 to change the plans for the first two ferries, including reallocating money. In Czech news, Sydney Island deer cull costs spiraling. Parks Canada wants to kill each and every one of the European fallow deer on Sydney Island. The program is costing $10,000 per deer killed during Phase 1. According to documents obtained by the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, in Phase 1 of the cull last fall, it spent more than $800,000. Including $67,000 in a helicopter to circle the island with snipers from the United States and New Zealand. The total budget is $12 million. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The virtual Nanaimo Bar. Brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to parents, guardians, pediatricians, teachers, daycare workers. It takes a village to raise a child, as they say. It's Child Care Month in BC throughout the month of May. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's
that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 26th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 26th of May in 1908, the first major oil strike in the Middle East in present-day Iran? The rights were acquired by the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. Or follow The Breaker News on X, formerly Twitter, for news as it happens. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.